Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The students have the right to protest and use civil disobedience the best way they can. This is what we call civil disobedience, peaceful marches, resistance.
But McGill University calls some of the tactics illegal, some of the behavior anti-Semitic. A pro-Palestinian protest camp growing on the Montreal campus calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and for the school to cut ties to Israel. A wave of similar protests in the United States has led to clashes and in some cases forced evictions. For now, McGill protesters say they aren't leaving. Welcome to Your World Tonight. It's Monday, April 29th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern. I'm Susan Bonner, also on the podcast.
I think we should have been told. You've got a bug in your office. It's important, if it's there, that you know about it, that you can do something about it, that you can take countermeasures to protect yourself.
A group of Canadian politicians hit by a cyber attack linked to the Chinese government, asking why they found out about the hack from the FBI. And the announcements get a lot of attention. Major EV projects coming to Canada with thousands of jobs. There are questions tonight about how many will go to foreign workers. There is a standoff developing at one of Canada's leading universities. At Montreal's McGill University, pro-Palestinian protesters are camped out for a third day. Talks between their lawyers and the administration have broken down, with McGill saying the encampment violates school policy and the law. It's a situation unfolding at institutions across the U.S. and now taking hold on Canadian campuses. Allison Northcott tells us more.
There are now dozens of tents covering part of the lawn in front of McGill University, surrounded by fencing, covered in signs and banners. One reads, "The revolution starts here." Another, "We won't rest until you divest."
These students have a right to use their voice, have a right to speak up.
Umnia Tarek is a Palestinian student and one of the organizers of the encampment. She says she'll stay here until McGill divests from certain companies and organizations with ties to Israel, which she says are supporting a war crime.
There have been many different ways that students have been attempting to get McGill to divest from genocide, and they have not been receptive in any way.
Protesters say they want the university to divest from a list of companies, such as one that manufactures weapons used by the Israeli military. The McGill encampment follows many others at colleges and universities across the U.S., with pro-Palestinian demonstrators demanding action and changes from their institutions. In recent days, an encampment has also started at the University of British Columbia, along with a protest at the University of Ottawa. McGill said in a statement that the situation has shifted and grown since Saturday, and said it had seen, quote, video evidence of some people using unequivocally anti-Semitic language and intimidating behavior, which is absolutely unacceptable on our campuses, unquote. But protesters at the encampment today disputed that, saying they don't tolerate anti-Semitism. Richard Davis is a McGill student protesting at the edge of the encampment.
I don't see anything anti-Semitic here, ever. And it's not actually anti-Semitic at all to be protesting against Israeli genocide of Palestinian people.
The university says many of the protesters are not from McGill and says while it supports freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, the encampments are against McGill's policy and against the law.
I'm one of the professors who stands in solidarity with the student movement.
Some faculty have been taking part too, like Rula Jordi, who teaches Islamic history at McGill.
What we are seeing is, a cry saying out from the students saying, this is not acceptable.
But there have been tensions, too, and criticism from those who say the protesters are out of line.
That's what the Germans did when the Jewish people were being persecuted. Shame on each one of you.
Quebec's higher education minister, Pascal Derry, said what happens next is up to McGill.
Everybody is on the same page. We don't want this to escalate, so we'll do everything we can. But it's up to the university to take the proper decisions.
This afternoon, those at the encampment were told by the university it was time to go.
So this is a final warning. Sir!
Still, even after the warning, many protesters remained. Alison Northcott, CBC News, Montreal.
And the protesters at Columbia University in New York say they aren't leaving. They set up encampments nearly 2 weeks ago. School officials gave them until this afternoon to leave or face suspension or even expulsion. As the deadline arrived, some faculty members in orange safety vests formed a protective line around them. The protesters say they will not voluntarily leave until their demands for divestment are met. Ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas have been stalled for weeks, but with international pressure mounting, there are signs a breakthrough could be coming. Today, the U.S. and the U.K. urged Hamas to accept a new deal. Briar Stewart has more from London.
Outside a hospital in Gaza, families once again prepare to bury their dead. Among those killed in the strikes overnight, an infant, now buried along with nine of his family members. 36-year-old Mohammed Abu Tahaha was there the moment after the airstrike destroyed three houses. Some were bleeding, some were dead, some were in pieces, he told a freelance journalist working for CBC News. As people sift through the rubble, there's no break from the sound of Israeli planes circling overhead. Even as Israel continues to insist it will eventually launch a military offensive into Rafah, there are some positive signs that both sides could be closer to a ceasefire deal.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he was hopeful about a deal while speaking at the World Economic Forum in Saudi Arabia today.
The only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
Reports of the potential deal suggest the ceasefire could last 40 days, and thousands of Palestinians imprisoned in Israel could be released in an exchange for fewer than 40 of the 130 hostages believed to be still in Gaza. It's estimated that about a quarter of them are presumed dead.
We are losing people that are alive now.
Ilan Siegel is the daughter of 64-year-old Keith Siegel, an American-Israeli hostage who appeared in a video released by Hamas last week.
To do everything and bring our people home now.
A delegation from Hamas was in Cairo, meeting with mediators from Egypt and Qatar. Egypt's Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly said the politics of Israel and Hamas are frustrating the negotiations.
A lot of pressure internally in both sides not to reach any kind of compromise.
And in Gaza, where people remain trapped in an increasingly desperate war zone, some have little faith there'll be any kind of reprieve. The negotiations are useless, says 44-year-old Ghaliya Boukouch. Everyone is fooling Gaza, even your own flesh and blood, they fool you. What is more likely, some believe, is what they've been experiencing for nearly 7 months. Another night of misery. Briar Stewart, CBC News, London.
Flash floods and landslides in central Kenya have killed at least 45 people. More than 100 are injured, and it's still unclear how many may be missing. Police initially said a dam burst, but government officials now say a river tunnel became blocked with debris. The water eventually overflowed and washed away buildings, trees, and a railway. The country has been inundated with rain this month, which has killed more than 140 people. Nearly 200,000 have been driven from their homes. Coming up on the podcast, a look at who could qualify for jobs at the massively subsidized EV auto plants. And you might want to check what happens to your benefits when you turn 65. Spoiler alert, it's not a story about them going up. Plus, we check in on the just-completed, politically charged Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Hear the personal takes of people who live alongside it. Two members of parliament, one liberal and one conservative, are calling out the federal government after it was revealed hackers linked to the Chinese government targeted Canadian politicians with malware. MPs are demanding to know why they had to learn about it from the FBI and not Canadian authorities. Tom Perry reports.
Mr. Speaker, as I informed your office earlier this morning, I am rising today on a matter of privilege. I'll briefly...
Rising in the House to raise the alarm, Conservative MP Garnet Jennis demanding to know why he and other parliamentarians were kept in the dark about a Chinese cyber attack that targeted them 3 years ago.
This was identified as a progressive reconnaissance attack, an attack aimed at gathering basic but useful information to be used for subsequent escalating attacks against us.
Word of the attack came from the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigations. The FBI says in 2021, a Chinese hacking group sent out a flurry of messages to politicians involved in IPAC, the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. IPAC brings together representatives from legislatures around the world and has been critical of China's communist regime. The FBI says it told governments, including Canada's, about the hacking attempt as soon as it was discovered. But parliamentarians here and in other countries only found out last week after investigators told IPAC.
Well, last Wednesday morning, we got a phone call from IPAC telling us that there was a strong likelihood that our emails have been hacked.
Liberal MP John McKay is one of those targeted and at this point isn't sure what to make of it.
I don't know is the short answer. I don't know whether I should be alarmed. And I don't know whether this should be just treated as a benign fishing expedition that is generating nothing at all.
Either way, McKay says, he would have liked to have known earlier he may have been targeted by Beijing. He and Jennis have issued a joint statement calling this an unacceptable attack on Canadian sovereignty and parliamentary privilege. Stephanie Carvin, a security expert at Carleton University, says they're right to be concerned. She says the hacking attempt, described as a pixel attack, is an effective way for hackers to gather information from a person's account by embedding malware in images or photos contained in an email.
This pixel attack might not give a lot of information to begin with, but it really does set attackers up for much larger, much more damaging attacks.
Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc today issued a statement saying democracies around the world are grappling with the threat of foreign interference. Not explaining, however, why in this case, parliamentarians apparently weren't informed of a specific threat so they could better protect themselves. Tom Perry, CBC News, Ottawa.
The federal conservatives are putting pressure on the Liberal government to be more transparent about how many jobs from the new multi-billion dollar EV battery plants will go to Canadian workers. The move comes as a group of unions sounds the alarm about the number of foreign workers building the Stellantis plant in Windsor. Kate McKenna reports.
Release the information. Prove me wrong. I dare you. Prove me wrong.
Conservative MP Rick Perkins telling a parliamentary committee that sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Well, what is the final number of allowable foreign replacement workers in this contract? And how much are Canadians going to have to pay to employ these foreign replacement workers?
His party is calling on the government to release the details of six government deals to build new electric vehicle battery plants. Federal and provincial governments have committed billions in dollars in subsidies in a massive industrial bet to shift Canada's auto sector towards EVs. But the government is facing questions about whether they've put guardrails in place to make sure those jobs go to Canadians. Questions from Conservatives and NDP leader Jagmeet Singh.
Whenever we give public money to projects in our country, we need ironclad guarantees that that will create jobs in Canada that are good paying, union jobs, and that the work stays in the country.
The question of foreign workers at these plants has dogged the government since last fall. But earlier this month, the head of Canada's building trades unions wrote to the Prime Minister saying jobs at the Stellantis site in Windsor, which could go to Canadians, are being done by foreign workers instead.
That is something that needs to be addressed in the strings attached to the funding.
The company Nexstar says only 72 of the nearly 2,000 workers at the Windsor site are foreign and that they're temporary. They're to install proprietary equipment. It says 2,500 new jobs will be created when the plant is built, and they'll be filled by Canadians. Plus, the federal immigration minister says part of the country's free trade agreements allow some foreign workers to come to Canada.
Prime Minister, thank you very much for coming today.
Today at a conference being held by Canada's building trades unions, Justin Trudeau was asked about protections for workers.
Will you commit to us that for this project and future projects, you will do everything that your government can do to make sure most of these jobs go to Canadian workers?
Yes. Absolutely yes. And let me again take a little bit of a step back. These are good jobs in an industry that is changing, so that we know there are going to be decades more good jobs.
His response was met with applause. But tomorrow, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre will be at the same conference to deliver his rebuttal. Kate McKenna, CBC News, Ottawa.
Retiring at 65 may have once been the dream, but today more and more Canadians are working well into their golden years, some by choice, others out of necessity. But what many workers, working seniors, don't realize is that their employee health benefits could significantly decrease once they hit 65, including losing short- and long-term disability insurance. Georgie Smythe explains.
God's good to us, so we're very thankful and blessed.
Stephen Booth from Barrie, Ontario, tries to stay upbeat about his circumstances. He's 66 years old, has some health problems, and works in retail to get by.
When do you think you'll stop working, Stephen?
I hate to say this and be blunt, but till I die, and not by choice. If I could retire now, I would.
He lost his private short- and long-term disability insurance when he turned 65. It's in the fine print of his workplace's group benefits plan, but no one warned him, and it came as a shock.
So that was just one more thing on top of everything else.
Booth is eligible for some government support, but it's much less than the workplace plan offered.
But it was between $600 and $700.
Every workplace and insurance plan is different, and employers can choose whatever plan they like to insure their employees. But the industry's policymakers say it's pretty standard for some disability coverage to end at 65.
Because that was traditionally the retirement age.
That's Sheila Burns, the Director of Health and Disability Policy at the Canadian Life and Health Insurance Association. She says insuring workers over 65 is expensive.
So you might not want to increase the cost of benefits for all your other employees for the small population who might be choosing to work after 65.
That was the situation at David Harvey's workplace in BC's Lower Mainland before he retired.
When I look at my T4 from my last years of working, I can see that the employer did not pay me as much in pay and benefits as they provided to my colleagues who were one day under 65 years.
He says workers who sometimes don't have a choice about working past retirement shouldn't receive less than their younger colleagues.
It's the first time in my life that I've really felt or understood viscerally what discrimination is about.
And how does it feel?
It feels shitty.
But Sheila Byrne says the debate isn't really about fairness.
Insurance is there to protect against a risk of loss. And someone who can't access their full retirement benefit would have a real risk of losing income. Someone who's over age 65 and has access to their full retirement benefit has less of a risk of that loss.
She says employees should put some time into understanding the finer details of their policies, like when coverage ends, and employers should tell their workers about the changes well before they reach 65. Georgie Smythe, CBC News, Vancouver.
Wildfire fighters in Ontario may soon have some of the same health coverage as other firefighters. That includes treatment for certain cancers and heart conditions associated with smoke inhalation. As Katie Nicholson tells us, for many, the proposed changes have been a long time coming.
Holy shit, took them long enough.
Kim LeBlanc doesn't mince words.
It's like, holy crap, my husband's, his last wish was that nobody else have to suffer through this.
After her wildfire fighter husband, Tom, died in 2010 from a cancer associated with firefighting, LeBlanc spent nearly a decade fighting for compensation.
When others run away from danger, firefighters run towards it.
Today, Ontario's Labour Minister David Piccini announced the province intends to grant wildfirefighters the same presumptive coverage as other firefighters for cancer, heart disease, and PTSD.
This is especially important as Ontario confronts a changing climate that brings new and extreme weather and wildfire risks.
Applauded by the opposition, it's likely to pass. For LeBlanc, it feels like closure.
Now it'll be an automatic. They won't have to waste all that time and money and heartache and, you know, wait for WSIB to respond. And then, of course, you got to pick at that scab where your heart's broken, that your family member is under severe pressure. And, of course, the person, like my husband, they were like, how do I look after my family? I'm leaving.
Mounting evidence suggests wildland firefighters develop many of the same cancers and diseases associated with smoke exposure that municipal firefighters get. But only five provinces offer wildfire fighters much of the same blanket presumptive coverage.
I think it's long overdue. And I think now if other provinces are paying attention that they need to expand it to each and every province in Canada too.
National Union of Public and General Employees President Bert Blunden also wants the federal government to give wildfire fighters the same national occupations classification as other firefighters.
And it really revolves about pension legislation and accrual rates and ability to retire early. Unfortunately, they're excluded as firefighters for those benefits and not recognized as firefighters at all, and we think that's a tragedy.
Kim LeBlanc says wildfire fighters across the country need to be treated the same.
It should be an level playing field. They should all be treated with respect and concern. And, given if you want us to do the job, then you best be looking after us.
And on the precipice of another potentially disastrous fire season, demands on wildfire fighters are expected to soar. And so inevitably will the risks they face. Katie Nicholson, CBC News. Toronto.
London Drugs has temporarily closed its 80 stores in Western Canada. The retail and pharmaceutical company says it's responding to a cybersecurity incident. In a statement, London Drugs says there's no evidence that customer or employee data has been affected. Pharmacists are still available on site for emergency needs. The company says it's working with cyber experts to fix and investigate what happened. It's been praised and vilified, bought and sold, delayed and rerouted. Tens of billions of Canadian taxpayer money is invested in the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. The just-completed line will move crude from Alberta's oil patch to the BC coast. Our Aaron Collins recently traveled the route to talk to people about the project. Today is the first of two installments about life along the line.
Not a lot of people live in Gainford, Alberta. Just under 120, not counting the chickens. Farming is big around here, and many who don't farm make a living pulling something else from the ground.
A lot of people in this area, if they're not farming, they're working in oil and gas or used to be working in the coal.
Don Watts runs a native plant nursery here. The Trans Mountain Line runs just across the highway from her land. Like many in the area, she's just fine with TMX and the industry it supports.
There's a balance for sure. I mean, we all have to eat. We have bills to pay. Most of us drive cars. A lot of things rely on the oil and gas still.
About an hour down the road, the main drag in Edson is a bit quieter these days.
Like when the oil field is us up and down, it's like we have lots of people, everyone has money, and then all of a sudden, everyone's gone.
Nancy Taylor Hill runs an eco-friendly bulk store here. She says the town was booming while the pipeline was being built nearby.
Then they left, and yeah, things definitely get quiet. Edson can be a little bit transient that way, where we have a lot of people and then we have like nobody.
The hope in Edson is that another big energy project will come down the pipe soon, fueling the economy here again. From Edson, TMX winds its way across the Rockies and then turns south, eventually crossing the territory of the Whispering Pines First Nation in BC.
Our state-of-the-art security system.
The line runs right across band member Mike Labordet's land.
We think about it all the time. We drive over it every day, and it's just something that we got used to, right?
Labordet, part of an Indigenous-led effort partnering with a Calgary company to try to buy TMX.
We've always lived with the risk, and now we want some of the benefit. Previously, the benefits always flowed somewhere else. Today, it goes to Ottawa. Previously, it went to Houston, Texas.
Further south, the pipeline passes through Kamloops, right by this dog park.
She's known as the Princess of the Park, my dog. And I've had people drive by and yell, Angie! They don't say
this park
name,
was closed during construction of the expansion, something that doesn't bother regulars Randy McKenzie and his dog Angie.
I think that is great that they twinned the pipe. Now we can actually move some oil safer.
Now that TMX is built, experts say it will provide a boost to the Canadian economy too. More access to tidewater for more Canadian crude will boost oil exports and should mean higher royalties for Alberta and more tax revenue for Ottawa. Of course, it all comes with a big price tag. The cost of the federally owned line skyrocketed to more than $30 billion. Aaron Collins, CBC News, Kamloops.
And finally, tennis players having temper tantrums is nothing new.
Well, here's another look at this McEnroe serve. I must say it looked to be on the line.
Oh, you can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line.
From John McEnroe to Serena Williams, on court outbursts tend to focus on the court. But this time the argument wasn't about serves, it was about the service.
I did try, Corinta. I told you. I can't get it myself. It doesn't matter where we play. It doesn't matter where we play. We don't provide coffee.
Can I go take a coffee then?
We don't provide coffee.
Why you don't provide coffee? Am I asking for caviar or something?
Corinta, I told you the decision. We need to play now.
The Madrid Open will not be getting a good review from Francis Corentin Moutet, who found out the hard way coffee is not on the menu during professional tennis matches, even if you ask to speak with the manager. While tournament officials couldn't help him, the crowd perked up. Moutet eventually got an espresso from a spectator. Might have been decaf, though. He eventually lost the match. Thank you for joining us. This has been Your World Tonight for April 29th. I'm Susan Bonner. Talk to you again.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.